All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a chief warrant officer, helicopter pilot in the United States Army, 1967 to 1971. Welcome to our program. We're live finally in 2023. We want to wish everybody a happy new year and hope that everything goes well for all of you. We've got a pretty interesting program today. I think we're going to have a gentleman named Ted Barker on, and Ted is going to be talking about the Korean War project. And, the Korean War is one of those forgotten things. And so the, as you may know, there is a memorial in Washington, D.C., and they're updating it. And so there's been a little bit of controversy. So hopefully, Ted can fill us in on that information. And then a little bit later on, we are going to have our, expert in foreign affairs, everything military, and that is Dr. Rebecca Grant. So make sure you stick around for these two really interesting stories. But first of all, I want to make sure that we thank all of our sponsors, because we can't do this program without their assistance and their monetary contributions, as they say. So I want to make sure we thank Legal Help for Veterans, specializing in veterans' disability claims. For more information, you can just go to their website. That's legalhelpforveterans.com, or give them a call at 800-693-4800. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as the NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for the certification of veteran-owned business. For more information from them, you can go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. The NVBDC is really important for those veteran-owned businesses that are out there. In order to do business with the federal government and many corporations, you need to be certified that you are really a veteran-owned business. And there's all kinds of hoops and so forth that you have to go through. These are the folks that can help you do that. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information, go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. We also want to thank our local veterans organizations here in the local area. That would be the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America, Chapter 310, and the Irwin Prescorn American Legion, Post 46, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. We can't do this program without their support, and we can't do it without you, our listeners. So if you want to help out Veterans Radio as we try to expand our markets, you can go to veteransradio.net, click on the donate button. We are a nonprofit organization, and so your donation should be tax deductible. All right, we're going to get right into the program right now. My first guest is Ted Barker, and Ted is with the Korean War Project, and Ted's been on the program before, but I want to welcome him back. Ted, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Dale. Thanks a lot for calling and having me on.
Thank you very much for agreeing to be on. I wanted to kind of review. You are an Air Force veteran, correct?
Yes.
And when did you serve?
Well, I actually started in 1963 and went active duty in 1966. And wound up with a overseas NATO-based tour in Europe and got out in 1970.
Sounds like a good plan for all of those that were in during that time period. You got to go to the, what'd you do? You must have gone east instead of west, right?
Well, I got there in Lowry Air Force Base. One morning we got orders and they told us to give us $160 to go buy green underwear. So the next morning they came out and Ross mustered again and said, nope, all you guys are going to Europe. We're taking everybody that has any experience and sending them to NCA. So I had a three-year tour in Europe.
All right. Well, you know, I tried to go to Europe many, many times. I tried to put in for Europe, and I kept getting places that were at the bottom on my list or not even on my list. Anyhow.
Well, you didn't talk to the chaplain, right?
I guess so. I should have done that. I never thought of it. Oh, wow. Oh, anyway, the reason that Ted, I wanted to have you and your brother were heavily involved in the Korean War Project, and I wish you would tell us a little bit about your organization.
We'll take a trip back to when we first got started. Hal had the concept of writing his book, and he couldn't get it published, and that was Return to Heartbreak Ridge. It was originally titled Heartbreak Ridge, but we know who took that title, Clint Eastwood. So in 95, we got internet access courtesy of two former super collider scientists, and we created our first online. And within about 36 hours of announcing it, I was getting phone calls and emails saying, what happened to me? Where was I? Do you have any maps? What happened to my grandfather? Where are my buddies, et cetera? And so it turned into what you see today, a multifaceted website. And it's still a work in progress.
It's a great, actually, I think it's a pretty good looking website you've got here. That's KoreanWar.org. And as you said, you've got everything, it looks like. And I, the reason I wanted to have you on, Ted, was because the Korean War has kind of, been called the forgotten war, and mainly because you didn't get a chance, it seems like, because after World War II, and then you guys hit, and then the Vietnam War kind of took over for the next 10 years or so, and the Korean veterans got, lost in the dust there, it seems. And you were able to do a number of things that I thought were really important. You were very influential in getting the Korean War Memorial, weren't you?
Yes, Hal founded it and took over from a corrupt organization and bypassed them and went to the American Battle Monuments Commission and made a donation to open a trust fund. And then he and Bill Temple, a Philadelphia 38th vet, walked the halls of Congress two weeks in a row with 2 minutes. We went 2 minutes, talked to all the committees. They said fine. They wrote up the legislation. The House said good. And then they went to committees, and they got stuck. And then Hal was fighting with Clint Eastwood over the title of Clint's movie, Heartbreak Ridge. Clint said, well, I'll call President Reagan. And after the phone call to President Reagan, the bill got out. First $1 million was put in by a Korean company. And then in 1995, it was the actual dedication. And we went to the dedication on a very, very hot Washington, D.C. week.
Yeah, I was reading the article and on your website about how you were taking water out to everybody and people were passing out because of the heat.
Yeah, they had these fences and they had a big bottle of water all wrapped up in bubble wrap, not open. And so I took a bottle and threw it at a Secret Service agent and got its attention and then tore down the fence and made everybody that was going up to the front reserve section out in the bright sunshine take water. So I missed the entire thing by handing out water, but wound up meeting hundreds and hundreds of really cool people.
Oh, I can only imagine. And you're in the process of upgrading the memorial. Is that what I understand?
Well, not us. We've had no relationship with the foundation, which was founded just after the Korean War memorial was dedicated. And we've been going back since 2014, being contacted by them, and they wanted to use our database. But then nothing happened for years until we found out it was actually being built. And last summer, we decided to publish our book of our best effort on the casualties, which is significantly different than the list that the government provided the foundation. But we've got a plan. This is all going to wind up getting settled in the media. There's been dozens of stories. But our plan is to use a very similar to what we've been doing with the Department of Missing Persons, the DPMO, DPAA, and having our interactive database where people can put information up directly, and it's up to the Department of Defense and the Korean government to buy into it. If they don't, it's not going to get done. But we're hopeful that the pressure that's being put on by the media will turn the tables. It's not been pleasant, but it is what it is.
Yeah, well, I don't want to get into the political aspect of it, but it appears that there are some names that are on the wall incorrectly, or there are some names that are not on the wall that belong on there, and it seems like they're... You would think that everybody would want to try to work that out.
There's been a lot of the Department of Defense and the Foundation have said, we got it handled, and we don't need your help now. The Department of Defense did call us in October and said, we need help. So we sent them about 500 names of the ones that should be on the wall. And then when we asked for more information, they said, well, you can FOIA us, but it's going to be 2 years. So we don't know what's going on with them, but... That's just what you wind up with when you're dealing with entities like the Department of Defense. They have their way, and your way may not be congruent, and that's it. But we'll get it solved. We've got a detailed plan, and hope that we can turn a corner. I know the Korean government has said that they will do everything they can to fix every single error, and we have not heard from either government since the articles come out. But there's a lot more coming out, and what we want is for at least 1,000 errors in spelling fixed. We want 500 names, including the head nurse of the Army, put on, and so far it's not going anywhere.
Well, maybe we can get a little groundswell going across the country.
Well, it's going on out there. I haven't been a big Twitter person, but all of the media are sharing, and the stories, there's been at least a dozen in Korea that we've interviewed, and at least 10 in the U.S. TV and New York Times, Washington Post, that have been seen about 150,000 times on Twitter or on online. So we're going in the right direction, and all we can do is hope the Department of Defense determines that the best interest to honor people is to get their full name correct.
Absolutely, absolutely. I know we've had some of those issues with the Vietnam Wall, the same.
Yes, and we've actually talked with the people who did the work, and it's interesting. The Washington Post did a story 4 years ago that the Department of Defense and the Vietnam Memorial folks spent 4 years on a line-by-line, case-by-case analysis to correct some duplications, and they wound up with only 35 errors that they finally discovered, which is remarkable since there's 58,000. And we've actually talked to the engraver who did the work on adding and fixing names. So hats off to them.
Well, we want to give hats off to you for what you're trying to do for the Korean War veterans. And for our audience, if you want to get more information, how do they do that?
Well, they can always go to our website, which is koreanwar.org. Our emails are listed at the top. You can call me at 214-320-0342. We answer it all the time. We both work at home. Twitter is out there at Korean War Vets. And our Facebook page is just look up Facebook Korean War Project. Any help is always, we can answer any questions. If they go up to our page for our book and scroll down past the ordering information, you can see the preface to our book that pretty well lays out what we've been doing over the last almost 30 years of doing this work. But we're still here, we're still going strong, and we hope to be around for some time honoring our Korean War veterans living and dead.
Well, I want to thank you very, very much for what you do, Ted, for you and your brother and your whole organization. I think it's just a great thing that you're trying to accomplish. And as you said, you've been doing this for a long time and not going to go away until we get it right.
Well, I thank you for your persistence and having people like Dr. Grant on and all your other fine people I've been following over all these years. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, actually, yeah, we're in, this is our 20th year. Holy moly.
Yeah, I've still got cassettes you sent me of our interviews. Who knew?
Who knew? Right. Right. Thank you very much. So we've been talking.
Thanks, Dale. All the best.
Same to you. All right. We've been talking with Ted Barker, who is from the Korean War Project. Their website is koreanwar.org. We're going to take a real quick break. And when we come back, Dr. Grant will be here to answer all of your questions about foreign affairs and Air Force jets and that really new secret B-21, which I really want to find out more about. All right, you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be back after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. First Lieutenant John Fox called in artillery fire on his own position. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
On Christmas night in 1944, enemy soldiers in civilian clothes gradually infiltrated the town Fox and his men were in, and by early morning, the town was largely in hostile hands. An organized attack by uniformed German units began at 4 a.m. B-21
Being greatly outnumbered, most of the American forces were forced to withdraw from the town, but Fox and other members of his observer party voluntarily remained on the second floor of a house to direct defensive artillery fire. Fox reported the Germans were in the streets and attacking in strength. He then called for defensive artillery fire to slow the enemy advance. As the Germans continued to press the attack towards the area that Fox occupied, he adjusted the artillery fire closer to his position. Finally, he was warned that the next adjustment would bring the deadly artillery right on top of his position. After acknowledging the danger, Lieutenant Fox insisted that the last adjustment be fired, as this was the only way to defeat the attacking soldiers. Later, when a counterattack retook the position from the Germans, Lieutenant Fox's body was found with the bodies of approximately 100 German soldiers.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit VeteransCrisisLine.net. VeteransCrisisLine.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
And we are back here on Veterans Radio, and now I'd like to introduce one of my favorite guests all the time here on Veterans Radio, and that is Dr. Rebecca Grant. Dr. Grant is a national security analyst based in Washington, D.C. She has her own organization called IRIS, Independent Research. She specializes in the research for government and aerospace industry. She's written over, hundreds and hundreds of articles. She's appeared on Smithsonian, Fox News, CNN, and on Veterans Radio, more than I can count. So I'm really excited to have her back on the program. So Dr. Grant, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Dale, it's great to be back and talking to you again and to your Veterans Radio listeners. Well, 2023, there's already so much to talk about with our foreign and defense policy. Can't wait to just dive right in with you.
I know. I've got a huge list here, not only from what you sent me, but some other things. I did want to just kind of give you a little congratulations shout-out that I see that you're a contributor on Fox News now, and that you have been writing opinion pages for them.
Yes, and you know, the great thing about Fox is they do really try to keep up with the international topics in foreign policy. They have reporters over in Ukraine now, and they do a really good job, and I'm really thrilled when they let me do a deep dive piece. I did a couple of pieces for them on the B-21 Raider, and those are still up in the opinion columns with FoxNews.com. And it's great to be able to tackle some of these issues. There's so much other news, of course, but they do a pretty good job at keeping China and Korea and, of course, Ukraine in the headlines for us.
Right, yeah. And in today's world, important news can get lost sometimes on all of the different outlets that are out there, because, you know, they're trying to keep up with each other and they're trying to, you know, what's the news story for the next 24-hour cycle?
That's right, and meanwhile, there are these international trends that are just really reshaping the place of the United States in the world, and they really have a lot of impact on us here at home, on us, and on our kids, and of course, on our military and the commitments that we expect from them. So it's good to I really enjoy the privilege of being on Fox, whether it's on their air or in their opinion pages, to kind of try to keep these issues in front of everyone.
Well, I think you are a reasonable source of information. Rational. Let's put that. You are a rational source of information, and I like that very much, because your word to me is gospel. It's true.
It's all about the facts. All about the military facts.
That's right. Just the facts. The old Dragnet program, right?
Correct.
Well, let's start off in the Ukraine, because that's still in the news. It's still such a terrible event that continues to go on now almost a year. What's happening there?
Coming up almost a year, and overnight there were heavy attacks across Ukraine again. This is part of Putin's strategy to try to attack civilian targets and the energy grid. It's really not working Ukraine is more adamant than ever that they won't give in. And what's such a shame to see is that they target civilian infrastructure. And, you know, last night in Dnipro, they hit an apartment building, and the pictures are just devastating. It's, you know, it's a multi-story apartment building. It was collapsed by a missile. Interesting, it's an older Russian missile. It was a NATO call sign, Kitchen. And it was actually an anti-ship missile at one point, but this was used against targets in Ukraine. And we're seeing a lot of this, of Russia using just about everything in their arsenal to launch attacks across Ukraine. And, you know, what happens in the end is that civilians get killed. Now, almost every energy grid target has been hit. But in addition to these terrible casualties in Dnipro, there was a little interesting trend that I noticed in this attack. So the Russians are actually using their air defenses, if you can stick with me for a second, their S-300 and S-400 air defenses. That's supposed to be missiles that shoot up and attack planes. Well, they have modified them to have a really short ballistic trajectory. So they put a couple of these Russian air defense batteries up in Belarus to the north of Ukraine, and they're shooting missiles into Ukraine towards the cities, and they have only a 2-minute flight time. So while Ukraine has done a great job at intercepting lots of the missiles and even the drones from Iran, hitting these ballistic trajectories with the 2-minute flight time is really tough. So it is just a brutal escalation. It has no impact on the fighting, where the main fighting on the ground is still in the east around Bakhmut, and that's pretty intense right now, and of course down in the south where Ukraine's taken back a lot of territory. But these are just, brutal terror attacks on Ukraine's civilians and then on their energy grid.
Well, it doesn't appear that Putin's too concerned about, what the world thinks of what he's doing, or what the Russian population think about what he's doing. And it almost sounds like he's bringing things out of mothballs, because maybe they're just running out of equipment.
They certainly are bringing out every type of missile and artillery shell that they have. Of course, one reason Putin can keep getting away with this is he still has 100% backing from Xi Jinping in China. You know, the word is that China would really like this war to be over, but they have not actually changed their policy. They've really deepened their ties with Russia over the past year, and by continuing to purchase Russian energy and to not condemn Russia, that means that China basically is still supporting Putin's operation in Ukraine. On the domestic side, you know, the Russian people, well, we all wish we understood more. There are Russian people who support the war in Ukraine. The media is very controlled there. But there are a lot of question marks as well. We hear that Putin is again trying to do at least a partial mobilization, a draft of additional Russians to go down into Ukraine and fight. Of course, they take individuals that are not well trained at all and put them right into the battle lines, and that's, you know, that just does not go well for them. Interestingly, they fired, they didn't really fire, but they did a command reshuffle in the last couple days. Back in the fall, they had brought in a commander called Sergei Serovikin, and he was the bald guy, okay? He had fought in Syria, really brutal commander, but he recently got demoted, and the top, kind of the last general in Russia, Gerasimov himself, who's their equivalent of our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he has now been put in charge of the whole operation. But the fact is, you know, Russia really doesn't have a good way to win here. The Ukraine really does have the momentum, but, you know, we're not seeing any signs at the moment that Putin is quite ready to quit. And, you know, kind of really keeping an eye on the indicators as to whether Putin wants to try another type of offensive or exactly what he'll do.
Well, do you think that we should, you know, continue keeping our pressure going by supplying, you know, military supplies and materials and so forth to them? We, you know, we and NATO are the ones that have to do that.
Yes, and, you know, we just have no choice at this point. I mean, I think over the last 11 months, Ukraine has really earned the support of the U.S. and the 48 nations in NATO and around the world that are supporting them. You know, at this point, what I see is NATO is just fully committed to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. You know, why we have no choice, you know, if we don't stop Russian aggression here, then all of Europe is not secure, really, from Finland to Istanbul. And you know, that's the same argument. I think Ukraine is deserving of this. I think they've proved that with their battlefield success. You know, what I'm seeing also is NATO start to do some longer-range planning, and very interesting move. For the first time, Ukraine will now be receiving main battle tanks, whether that's they're coming from different countries, from the U.S., also from Britain. Actually, Britain's will arrive first. And that, to me, says, you know, they're looking at what Secretary of Defense Austin talks about as the long-term defensive posture in Ukraine. You know, we hope to see Ukraine take more territory through the spring and summer and then have this come to an end, but there's still going to be the issue of defending Ukraine, and they want to make sure that can go forward. And then, of course, as your listeners probably know, there's also been a big emphasis in improving Ukraine's air defenses. An interesting recent development there is we're actually going to see they come from Ukraine's Air Force. They'll be going to Fort Sill to learn how to train on the Patriot air defense battery that President Biden has promised to them. Not unusual here. We've got Ukrainians training in some other NATO allied countries as well, notably Britain and Germany. I think we do have to continue to support. And remember, you know, it's not just the U.S. There are the 48 countries providing. It's a mix of direct military aid, security assistance, humanitarian relief, and economic loans. And, you know, I really look at a country like Poland, which, of course, has a border. They have taken in 1.4 million Ukrainian refugees, mostly women and children. As the men have gone back to continue fighting, the women are getting jobs in Poland. It's been an issue because of language in the schools, right? But a lot of Ukrainian refugees there in Poland where they are most welcome. But Poland has sent about half of its armored forces into Ukraine already, the equipment, not the soldiers. But, you know, of the tanks that they have sent about 400 already for Ukraine to use. I mean, they just have, and they want to buy more, they will get a backfill of some U.S. Abrams tanks. So, you know, we really, to sum this up, you know, we have no choice but to continue this support. This is, China has got to see Russia lose in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I think, as you pointed out, all these NATO nations, if the Ukraine does fall, then, you know, then Russia's on their borders. And it's, you know, you don't like to use this slippery slope analogy, but that's, you know, you take that little country, then you take another little one, like nobody's looking. That's, it seems like he doesn't seem to think that anybody else in the rest of the world is actually looking at what he's trying to do.
Exactly. And you're so right. You know, there's the Baltic Republics, Poland, the countries that share a border along there. I mean, they just cannot live with a militant, aggressive, imperialist Russia, which is what we see under Putin. And, you know, one thing as the news coverage has downscoped a good bit on Ukraine, of course, but when you look at something like the attack recently, the missile attack that took out the apartment building in Dnipro, every village or town where Russia is fighting, they're just leveled. It looks like World War One, or the worst battles of World War Two.
Yeah.
The shelling is unbelievable. The civilian populations in the towns that are changing hands in the east there, you know, in Donetsk and Luhansk, and of course what we saw with Mariupol in the south before it fell, with Kherson, which Russia took and then had to evacuate under Ukrainian pressure. There are things are mined, booby trapped, turn to rubble. The devastation is just it's just staggering. I mean, this just has to stop at Ukraine. There's no question Russia has to lose. We have to do what it takes to help Ukraine win.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more on that one. I did want to add one little tidbit to that, and that was to talk about the weapons that are coming from Iran.
Oh, yes, the weapons from Iran. You know, and so this is, Russia has been purchasing a couple of types of drones. Iran had started building drones. You know, our forces encountered them in Syria and Iraq, even shot a few down several years ago. But now Iran is steadily supplying Russia with drones to use in its energy grid attacks and attacks on civilians in Ukraine. It's terrible. And how do we know this is happening? Well, the White House releases the intelligence, and you see the picture of the drones that are shot down. And so Iran and Russia are very, very open about it. And it tells you, again, you know, this is a reason why this just can't work. This axis, if you will, has to be defeated. Iran has long had really close relations with Russia. You know, Russia is building them a big nuclear plant, all this sort of thing. And, again, energy relationships there, too. So, you know, this is about shutting down Iran. We can't have Iran be successful in sending these drones in. It does tell you, though, that Russia's pretty desperate. There's not many people now who will sell. And most drones have a really global supply chain set of components in them. And it's pretty easy to say, yep, okay, no more supplies of those. But they are buying the Iranian drones. They're not drones that can change the front lines of the battlefield very effectively, but they certainly are causing havoc in Ukrainian cities against Ukrainian civilians. It is just terrible, and how typical of Iran to sell drones like that for that war.
Yeah, it's a normal behavior for them, although they're running into some problems internally with their, the punishment or the execution of the woman for not wearing her hijab. What's it called? Hijab. I forget. I can't pronounce it right now. But, and then they're threatening with one of their soccer players?
Yes. After the incidents that occurred in September, which probably folks remember, a young woman was taken into custody because she wasn't wearing her hijab, her headscarf, and she died in custody. And this set off waves of protests. You know, she's basically arrested, basically died because her hair was showing. Okay, and this set off waves of protests in Iran through the fall. Iran arrested a lot of people, whether they were just marching in the street or what, and has executed some. And one of the people that is potentially in line to be executed, and it's horrible, is a man who was a pro soccer player in Iran. And obviously, soccer, as they would say, football is a very, very big sport in Iran. And so this has really kind of lit up Iranian social media. And there have been other executions of individuals who, for taking part in demonstrations and riots across Iran. And these really are more, you know, riots is probably the wrong word. These really are more demonstrations in support of women's rights and against the strong clerical rule in Iran. They're continuing to do executions. They seriously could overreach here. This is, you know, this is really playing with fire on the part of the Iranians, and of course so terrible and tragic and unnecessary.
I agree. We're just not used to these types of behavior, and it's always so shocking when we hear that somebody was executed or thrown in jail or whatever for whatever the offense might have been, that, you know, without any, real defense, the attorneys or, anything in the laws are just kind of willy-nilly. Let's move to another part of the world, although it's not any safer over there. I was going to go to Korea next because our good friend, right, Kim Jong-un has been, blasting off his missile tests recently.
Kim Jong-un had a big year in 2022. And, I was listening, of course, when you were talking with Ted Barker and the Korean War Project. Just think of the sacrifices Americans have made there. in what they always called the Forgotten War. And, you know, at the time that the Korean War was fought, it was not real well publicized that our troops and pilots and sailors were fighting Russians and Chinese in so many cases. It was terrible. Anyway, the outcome of that is, you know, Kim Jong-un, and in 2022, he fired 69 missiles. This just smashed his previous record from 2017, which was 25 missile tests. Now, most of those are older, short-range type, you know, classy 1960s technology. But about 8 to 10 of his missile tests in 2022 were much more concerning because they were tests of long-range missiles. So let me be blunt. Kim Jong-un wants to develop a nuclear-capable missile that can hit the United States. He's not there yet. They still have technical difficulties. A couple of these 8 or 10 tests of the longer-range systems were complete failures. However, a few of them were at least partially successful in testing various systems necessary for an intercontinental missile. And again, he's not there yet, but the more he tests, the more he learns. And at the same time, relations with South Korea have just gone downhill. You know, just 2 weeks ago, the North Koreans sent 5 drones into South Korea's airspace, one of which apparently got pretty near the presidential complex, you know, there in Seoul, and it was just a shocking event. You know, the Koreans are pretty used to the North. You know, our forces there have that motto, ready to fight tonight. They're used to these threats and provocations, and they're pretty tough, and their military is very prepared. But the drones flying over Seoul, I mean, this was terrible. And as a result, you know, they think that Kim Jong-un at this point is really aiming to develop possibly even a full nuclear triad, and that has a lot of consequences for South Korea's long-term defense posture, too.
It certainly does. I mean, this has been going on for 70 years now or more.
It has, and if you think back, it was President Eisenhower in 1953, he got elected partly by promising to go to Korea and solve that war. And as negotiations were so close but breaking down, he delivered a very back-channel threat to use nuclear weapons if he had to. And the threat was effective, and they backed down and they agreed to the armistice that is still in place. So for U.S. policy, you know, we still, of course, have about 28,000 soldiers and airmen on the peninsula that are there that are in cooperation with South Korea's military, very capable. But the new element in the last 2 or 3 months is that now there are discussions in South Korea about whether they should ask the United States to return the tactical nuclear weapons. Those would be primarily air-delivered weapons that were once stored on the Korean Peninsula during the Cold War. They were removed, you know, back in the 1990s. And there have been some reports that the U.S. and South Korea will do a kind of a nuclear joint exercise, not with any nuclear weapons, but exercising the procedures as necessary. You know, what's really tragic here is back in 2018, in the year of 2018, when President Trump and Kim Jong-un were negotiating, Kim actually stopped. He didn't do any missile tests at all in 2018, and it looked like maybe there was a chance to lure him into a different policy. But at this point, that sadly is gone. People wonder about China's ability to influence North Korea. And there are kind of two schools of thought. One is that China just doesn't care about North Korea's nuclear weapons. It probably suits them now to have North Korea as a provocateur to South Korea and to the U.S. And the other, maybe even more worrying part of this is whether they really have the influence over North Korea. You know, I sort of think they do because of that border and they control a lot of the trade. But North Korea completely shut down due to COVID. And Kim Jong-un's, you know, his family philosophy is we can hold out against anything. So what we see is increasing nuclear development. I think China's assisting them or has assisted them in the past. And so at this point, you know, we really have to look to expect a higher rate of potential nuclear development coming out of North Korea. We already know they have nuclear weapons. There is a high expectation they may do a seventh nuclear test at some point. Luckily, we do still have our West Coast missile defenses, the interceptors in California at Vandenberg and up in Alaska, that are really designed to go against a rogue North Korean nuclear threat. But the trends are very worrying indeed.
Well, we are talking here with our good friend Rebecca Grant, our foreign affairs, military awareness and expert here, and you're listening to Veterans Radio. When you were talking about the where North Korea was going with their possible new weapons, I wanted to make sure that we got in this conversation about this B-21.
Yes, the B-21.
Tell me about this airplane.
Well, Dale, this is a good news topic. The B-21 is the Air Force's new stealth bomber, and you probably hadn't even seen any pictures of it in the press, right?
No.
No, and it was kept very secret. They started development back in 2015, but on December 2nd of last year, the B-21 rolled out of its hangar, and I've got to tell you, I was there in California to see it. It was such a privilege and so exciting. It rolled out just after dark, and the location is Palmdale, you know, near Edwards Air Force Base, which is the land of secret aircraft. And unusual for California, it was a foggy, cold evening, very misty. The Air Force did a flyover with a B-52 bomber and then a B-1 and then a B-2 bomber, which is the original stealth bomber. And then out came the B-21 from its hangar. Wonderful moment. The Secretary of Defense was there. Lots and lots of people. I had a seat, you know, many, many rows back, but it was great. It's a beautiful airplane. It really is very, I would describe it as bird-like. It's avian. It's, you know, can't see any engines. The engines are completely hidden away. It is, of course, stealthy, so it's basically a flying wing. It's gray, kind of a dove gray color. Very unusual little cockpit windows, not like a big screen like, you know, like on my husband's truck or even like on the B-2 bomber, but just kind of small front cockpit windows. Really a marvel of American technology.
Well, this thing can be flown with or without a pilot. Is that my understanding?
Well, I think it could be. I mean, certainly it will have pilots to start with, and it has to go through its flight test program. We're expecting to, it hasn't flown yet. We expect to see that happen sometime the middle of this year. But the Air Force has not said much about this bomber at all, of course, to keep it secret, which we want them to do. But there are some Air Force documents suggesting that this is what they call optionally manned. So it can have a crew, probably a crew of two, like the B-2 bomber, but it's possible that in some scenarios this could fly in an unmanned profile in the future. Very, very exciting.
I would think that's a really big drone.
Yes, and like a drone, it's got that wedge shape to it. It is a little bit smaller than the B-2 bomber, which it will replace. But that makes it just that much stealthier. And remember, our bomber weapons have changed a lot in the last 30 years. This is the first new American bomber in 34 years. And what once took a 2,000-pound bomb can often now be accomplished with a smaller 500-pound or 250-pound munition. So that meant that the B-21, which is called the Raider, could have a somewhat smaller bomb bay for the missions it's designed for. And, you know, the best thing about this, China has nothing like this. Russia has nothing like this. And for me, it was particularly a thrill to see all the workers from the plant. So it rolled out of one of the hangars at the plant. It was only out about 20 minutes, and they put it back in. But it was great to see the workers there at the ceremony and how excited they were and how proud they were. They've kept working right through COVID. They never stopped. And apparently they have six of these B-21s in some stage of production there at the Northrop Grumman plant in Palmdale, California. Really, really a triumph for American technology and so needed for nuclear deterrence in the future.
Wow. I can tell you're excited. You are definitely a fly girl. That's for sure.
It was a very exciting to see it, and because just the culmination of so much hard work. And again, so important now, you know, because part of the problem here is that China is also building up their nuclear forces. And so looking ahead, America has to be able to have a nuclear deterrence triad that can deter Russia and China and deter both at the same time. And that's new in American policy, and the B-21 will be a very big part of that.
Well, I think this is really great information for our audience to understand that, you know, that we are continuing to develop our, you know, attack systems and our defense systems. I mean, you also mentioned that there's a new missile that was fired off in December, the Arrow, hypersonic Arrow.
Yes, December was a good month for the Air Force and its new capabilities. So this took place just 1 week after the B-21 rollout. There was a successful test on December 9th of a hypersonic missile, and it's called Arrow. That's its nickname based on its acronym. And it is a missile that flies at least Mach 5, that's five times the speed of sound. And then the important thing about Arrow is this is an operational missile. They are very close to being able to take this. This is not just a test. This is not just a research program. This is the kind of missile that you can deploy forward to the Pacific or to Europe or wherever it needs to go as a deterrent and as a weapon. Now, it's a conventional missile. And, of course, Russia already has a couple of these hypersonic missiles, and they've actually used one or two in Ukraine. You never know with Russia whether they actually have a shelf full of their hypersonic missiles or just one or two, or really how good they are. But we know that this Arrow test by the U.S. Air Force it's really a big milestone, because there was a lot of debate about, wow, did the U.S. get behind China and Russia in hypersonics? And, well, let me tell you, with Arrow, there should be no more questions about that. So Arrow will provide a hypersonic attack capability, conventional capability for U.S. Air Force aircraft and for other services as well. So it's kind of the beginning of a stronger new era of hypersonic weapons for the U.S. military, and it really, really needed to keep up with the challenges out there.
There are obviously many, many challenges out there, and you wrote about China and eight reasons that we needed to be wary of them. I don't know. We've got about 8 minutes to go, so it's a couple of minutes for each one.
I tell you, you know, you could have written about 100 reasons to be wary of China, but I think, you know, the first one has to be their nuclear development. China they've had nuclear weapons since the 1960s, but a fairly small number. They just wanted this small deterrent. Then along comes Xi Jinping. You know, he's got his third term as ruler for life, and a few years ago he decided that they would start new plutonium production. They would dig out new missile fields, and he wants to build enough nuclear weapons to get up to about where the U.S. is, at about 1,500 weapons. It's crazy. There's just no reason for this to happen. And, of course, China, they don't do arms control. That's not something that they're interested in. They won't even talk about it. I mean, we have enough other issues with China, but arms control is just not a possibility with them. And, you know, there's just a lot to worry about. Of course, there's Taiwan. I mean, you've sort of followed the news on Taiwan, right?
No, the Chinese jet came very close to one of ours.
Yes, and you know we've seen that in the past, and it's so unsafe because remember there was the incident with the EP-3 that did collide with a Chinese fighter about 20 years ago now, and actually the Chinese pilot was killed in the incident. The EP-3 had to land on Hainan Island, and you know it shows you how unsafe China is. And the other thing that they've been doing a lot, as your listeners probably know, is flying big guerrilla packages, if you call them, you know, really mass packages of fighter aircraft into Taiwan's air defense identification zones. And it started with, well, maybe 15 or 20 aircraft, and then I was surprised to see they were flying 30 aircraft in a package. The most recent package was 71 aircraft.
What does Taiwan think when they see that on their radar?
Yeah, right. I mean, this is big, right? And you know, I had an uncle in the Marine Corps who was stationed on Taiwan back when it was called Formosa with you know, defense interceptor squadrons. So two things that worry me about this. One is China's trying to show that they can do an air and naval blockade of Taiwan and use that for coercion. The other thing is that, of course, China's practicing. So when they put together these big packages of aircraft, you know, part of what our military watches is, how well did it go? You know, did they all join up at the right time? How was their flying? And by the fact that China is flying more and more of these large force packages of so many aircraft, it really tells you they're trying to improve their military skill. Because remember, China has zero recent combat experience, and we want to keep it that way. But unlike, you know, even Russia that's fought in Syria and various places, China really has not fought in a long, long time. So they're using these big exercises against Taiwan to boost their combat skills. And then I think the other thing, just two other things to point out, I won't go into all eight, is, of course, the partnership with Russia. You know, there was a time when analysts in Washington thought it wouldn't really happen. Chinese and Russians, you know, kind of, it's sort of an arrangement of convenience. They have a lot of bias against one another. But for now, their partnership is very strong, and they do a lot of joint military exercises, and it's just bad. It's bad news for us and for the West. And then I think the other thing is, you know, what will become of Xi Jinping as he relaxes the zero COVID policy? You know, there were protests against the COVID lockdowns, and he really had to kind of back off and allow a bit more flexibility. Long-term questions, too, about the slower growth of China's economy. You know, just for a data point, China has more than 250 million citizens that are over the age of 65. So the vulnerability to COVID, they won't use the mRNA vaccines because they weren't made in China, although I believe that Pfizer is now looking at selling those into the Chinese market under a different label. But there's a lot of potential political ups and downs in China. But no question, they are, as the Pentagon says, the pacing threat. They are the threat we have to worry about. We know that they're very strong economically, of course, and they're strengthening all the time militarily. And so, you know, keeping China deterred is essential to the American way of life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's so many, many more things that I would love to talk with you about, Rebecca. I'm going to have to bring you back again, as usual, and to talk about some of these things. I think the message I wanted to get out to our audience was, you know, that we are pretty prepared here in America to, if necessary, defend ourselves from these different organizations.
Our military is prepared, and it's still part of our responsibility as Americans to support our military and our allies, and in the cases where we have no choice but to do the right thing, as in supporting Ukraine and deterring China, we have to keep that strong. That's part of our American way of life at this point. We have to do it in our own interests and in the interests of our like-minded allies around the globe. America's got to stay in the game.
You got to stay in the game. So, I mean, you got to stay in the game too, because you are our expert on this. And I want to thank you very much again for being on Veterans Radio. We've been talking with Dr. Rebecca Grant, and, you can follow her on, just type her name into Google, not the actress. Don't do the actress, but type her name in there and you can find all of her articles and so forth on the web. It's really, it's good reading, and you feel very, I feel very confident whenever I read anything that you write, Rebecca.
Well, I have such great confidence in our military. They are the best.
They are the best. And on that note, we'll end our interview for today. Thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio again. Again, this is our 20th anniversary, so we're going to have you back before the year is over.
Terrific. Thank you, Dale.
All right. Thank you. All right. Dr. Rebecca Grant, talking all about what's going on in the world. We had Ted Barker on talking about the Korean War Project. This is what we do here on Veterans Radio, and this is why we encourage you to go to our website, veteransradio.net, and click on that donate button, because we want to bring all of these stories to you. Next week, we've got a really good program coming up. It's a doctor, a MASH doctor in Vietnam, and he's going to be talking about his experiences as an anesthesiologist in Vietnam and the work that he had to do there, and of course his private practice. But the really interesting part of that is we have a guest who was treated by him in Vietnam, and they have reconnected, and that's a really cool story. So until next week, this is Dale Thronberry for Veterans Radio. You are dismissed.